welcome to the first Our Science podcast of 2015. I'm Naomi Asantewasatri.
And I'm Stefan Janusz. It's an auspicious year for the Society and a big year for scientific anniversaries in general. 100 years since Einstein's theory of general relativity, 150 years since James Clerk Maxwell showed light was an electromagnetic wave, and 350 years since the Royal Society's first curator of experiments, Robert Hooke, wrote the first popular science book, Micrographia, featuring beautiful and terrifying images revealed by early experiments with microscopes, which was published by the Society.
It's also 300 years since the first citizen science experiment, organised by none other than famous comet hunter Edmund Halley in 1715 to ask for help tracking a total solar eclipse. What ties all of these anniversaries together, in addition to many of the famous experiments and world-changing ideas in history, is one big idea, the Scientific Journal.
350 years ago this March, back in 1665, the Royal Society launched the world's first journal wholly dedicated to science, Philosophical Transactions. The journal revolutionised not only how science was communicated, but also had a huge impact on the way science itself works, making it much faster to share knowledge and easier to figure out who was behind the discovery. It also established the concept that the best people to check scientific ideas that were to be published were in fact other scientists, allowing modern-day peer review to develop. Now there are tens of thousands of journals which altogether publish over a million articles a year, and all of them work in some way like Philosophical Transactions, which incredibly is still with us today. So with an archive of past authors that stretches from Isaac Newton to Stephen Hawking, Caroline Herschel to Dorothy Hodgkin, and Edmund Halley to Colin Pillinger, we want to celebrate not only the big ideas in science reported in the journal, but the way the journal itself changed how science is done.
In March, we're launching Science Stories, a series of films featuring fellows of the Society and researchers we fund talking about how the impact the journal had on the scientific method allowed these ideas to flourish. Last year, we asked some of the UK's top communicators of science, including some of our fellows, to come up with important and interesting stories in scientific publishing history and to help us put together the films. We caught up with the chair, Dame Uta Frith, and committee members, Sir David Spiegelhalter, and our foreign secretary, Sir Martin Polyakov, after a meeting at the Society.
It is quite remarkable that science publishing has had this continuous history here at the Royal Society, that it's a model that's been actually adopted everywhere, and that's probably at the very root of the remarkably cumulative effect of science, so that it's not just people doing science, but it's communicating their science so that other people can criticize it if they want to, can do experiments to elaborate or extend what's being said. So the publishing of science is in itself, I think, an incredibly important contributor to the success of science in the last 350 years.
Oh, it's really challenging being on a committee like this, full up with people who are used to communicating difficult ideas in science, and then trying to plan and to look at films that people make about it. I think it's completely riveting, but it also quite difficult, because it's not just about scientific ideas, it's about the communication, the history of the communication of scientific ideas through the medium of science journals.
It's great fun. And, of course, not everybody agrees, which makes it even more fun. And, in fact, what is interesting is that there's quite a diversity of views, but what comes out at the end is probably better than any one of us individually could have thought of.
The possible arguments that happen all the time in science, and that of course are particularly interesting from the point of view of publishing, where as soon as something comes out and is written down, somebody else can say, but that can't be true, and I have a much better explanation. So this happens all the time.
Well, I love scientific papers. I love looking through old journals. I love looking at the fonts and the way they were printed and the diagrams. And because it does bring you down to earth slightly, because you get away from this idea of the heroic soul scientist working away in the laboratory making these eureka discoveries. Nonsense. This thing is a collaborative work. It's all incremental. It's always using other people's ideas as well, and then having your own criticised, and it gradually moves things forward. And so it's much more realistic, but of course less sort of sexy and dramatic. Published papers often look staggeringly dull.
In my own scientific lifetime, the way that people have written has changed, partly because now with computerised typesetting and everything else, it's much easier to write and publish as much as you want. Whereas before, when it was set manually, there were much greater space constraints, and people used to write much shorter papers, which were often much slicker and easier to read.
One example is about sustainability. So even a few hundred years ago, even right at the beginning of the Royal Society in the 17th century, people were concerned with the sustainability, for example, of forests. You know, if you felled all the trees to build ships all the time, would there be a day when there just wouldn't be any woods anymore? And we are still struggling exactly with that. So that's one of the stories. Another story that we found incredibly exciting, doesn't date back so far, is the beginning of the space age and the interesting contributions of fellows of the Royal Society in getting a space program started.
My favourite paper in Phil Trans was by the Reverend Thomas Bayes in 1763. He'd been dead for 2 years, for heaven's sake, but at least the paper got published, and that set the idea for Bayesian subjective probability and the analysis of data from a Bayesian perspective. It's a terrible paper. It's almost unreadable, dreadful notation, very quite obscure arguments, except sometimes he does have some amazingly clear expressions of exactly what he's trying to achieve in this paper. And the expressions I use now in my current lectures, I just cut and paste a little bit from Phil Trans of 1763 and used in my lectures.
There are a few classic papers. The work of Michael Faraday, for example, is beautiful to read it. But most scientists' papers are more factual than something that you would read for pleasure.
Who are we? Where do we come from? The mysteries of the mind and the brain, which have also been considered in publications of the Royal Society journals, but only very recently is there actually some tangible progress as to how the mind works, how the brain works. But we can look at the origins very, very much earlier. And also I'm looking forward to talking about the future of publishing. I think we will hear a lot about how, after all this time, when all we had was print and paper, which of course was a huge technological advance to, say, the Middle Ages, we now have the internet, we're not dependent on paper and ink at all anymore, and we can also be much speedier in publishing things than we used to be, maybe even only 50 years ago. And people are much more ready, I think, to critique and comment.
And other ways that, you know, mathematicians and physicists are using, for example, using archive, where you upload preprints and people can examine those and discuss them before publication, I think is, you know, frankly, it's a model which I think is more appropriate to the modern age. So I think there's always going to be some need for a permanent repository with a date and a timestamp on these things. But I think the current publishing model, frankly, is going to go through some considerable revisions in the future.
Well, one of the things is that it has greatly increased the speed with which things are published and the speed that people can access and read them. It also means that people can include very much more experimental data. But probably the most important thing is it makes it much easier to search the literature, because you can find really obscure papers, though you might not always be able to read them unless they're on open access. But on the other hand, you can find out the existence of these papers in a way that would have been really difficult even when I started science in the late 1960s.
I think it will be great to have such a birthday celebration, such an amazing anniversary like the 350th. We will, of course, launch the website, which will not just have the videos, these stories that I've just been talking about, but it will have papers from the major journals, from particularly the Philosophical Transactions.
I don't think that one can predict what is going to happen, but one can say with reasonable certainty that scientists will be continuing to publish their results for as long as scientists are doing science.
Back in December, the Royal Society and US National Academy of Sciences jointly organised a 2014 SECLA forum on cybersecurity entitled Cybersecurity Dilemmas, Technology Policy and Incentives. The forum took place in Washington, D.C. and brought together UK and US scientists, industry experts and members of the policy community to discuss cybersecurity and international relations, incentivising rational cybersecurity systems, privacy and the use of personal data, as well as examining progress in cybersecurity policy.
We spoke to Eric Grace, Vice President of Privacy and Security Engineering at Google, and Craig Mundy, former Chief Research and Strategy Officer at Microsoft, to explore how cybersecurity and privacy are related, to bust some privacy myths, and to get their ideas for improving trust in an online world.
Why is cybersecurity important, Eric?
People have a lot of data online these days, and it's hard to recover from loss of that data. So that's the top reason for us why security is important.
Craig?
Yeah, I would generalize it a little bit more. The computer world is essentially getting diffused into every aspect of our daily lives now, whether it's at work or play. And so in a sense, it's not just about the data. It's about how the machine intersects our life. And so for the same reasons that we worry about security as it relates to crime, for example, in the physical world, when these two things are not separable any longer, we'll need to worry about security writ large in the cyber environment too, because all the bad things that we know in the physical world are going to show up in the cyberspace.
So what is the relationship between cybersecurity and privacy?
Well, first of all, if you don't have good security, then you certainly don't have good privacy either. But many people think the two are in opposition because in order to run various kinds of security, we need a lot of data that gives us some risk factors. Like, so we may try to decide whether your account has been hijacked and it's not really you, it's someone pretending to be you. It's useful to us to know some more things about you in order to distinguish. And so there are some nuances there where it can be a little tricky. But on the whole, I think the two really work well together.
Yeah, I agree with Eric. In a sense, security in a computer system is like the foundation you build your house on. And if your house is the privacy house, then if you don't have a good foundation, the house won't stand up. Many people confuse the two or think it, as he said, that they're in opposition, but in fact, privacy depends on security. Most of the problems that you read about today in privacy actually come from security failures, and indeed you can lose privacy that way. But as we improve security in computing, more and more the privacy problems will just become the policy issues of what permitted uses do we make with the data that we have, and how does that affect your privacy?
Craig, you spoke in your talk about some privacy myths. I wonder if you could elaborate on that a bit here.
Well, I think that as people talk about the uses of data, they oftentimes take solace in the idea that, well, if my identity can be hidden, then I should be able to go ahead and use this data. But in the world of big data, as we call it now, which is really the ability to take very powerful computer systems and huge amounts of disparate information and fuse them together, this anonymization concept is increasingly at risk. Because no matter how subtle the data is, we often can find something it correlates to that's already been published. And if you do that enough times, you can usually re-identify anybody. So I'd say anonymization is the biggest myth in the privacy discussion these days.
What do you think, Eric?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. We're extremely cautious about any claims of anonymization. Fortunately, sometimes you don't need to anonymize individual data. What you can do is run an algorithm that's been carefully reviewed over a lot of individuals' data and derive some aggregated data. So if you think about an election, say, we don't want you to be able to see how a particular person voted, but we want some reliable ways to figure out what the totals are and perhaps get some, not just have the total, but have some information about the demographics. You want to know something about the population, who tended to support which candidate. So that's the kind of way in which we'd like to analyze data while preserving privacy.
But of course, all of these things are tricky because you can apply such an algorithm, but if it turned out that you said that a particular voting precinct happened to be very small, was a remote rural one, you could run the same algorithm, on a precinct of 100 people and probably still figure out, who people were. So, it's a difficult thing. And increasingly, we just don't believe that this idea of masking is going to be the way. It's why I advocate that we have to start thinking about controlling the uses, because then you can explicitly say, well, that's a permitted use and this is not a permitted use, and you don't have to worry about these kind of questions. You just deny the things that you don't like.
And this is why it's really an exciting field to be in. First of all, there are clever algorithms and statistics to do to try to be sure that we don't fall into these traps in privacy. And on the security side, it's a never-ending game because it's always smart humans against other smart humans, and it's just never-ending battle. So it's a fun area to be in.
So Eric, you mentioned trust as being a key factor. Why is it so important, and how could we go by strengthening?
So much like fixing your car, the details of getting this stuff right are somewhat esoteric. And so it's fun for people in the field to get into this and work on it. But for the average person, it's not fun to have to master all those details. So people will depend on someone else. It might be they depend on a thought leader who's carefully reviewed that material and they decide what to use. And it may be they depend on a brand. That's a classic way that companies establish there's some premium for buying their product because they have, over a period of years, earned people's trust. You've learned that if you buy something with that brand, you won't be disappointed. So that's why trust really matters. It's because there's this asymmetry of information. Some people know more about what the true risks are than others, and so you as a consumer want to know who you can trust.
And Craig, what do you think?
Yeah, I think trust is important, not just in the cyber world. I mean, and in this case, I think, as Eric mentioned, in a sense, brand is essentially a proxy for trust. Brands essentially develop, they have a reputation, people associate some quality or attribute with the brand, and that becomes an important part of their purchase decisions. And I think that as the public finds this intersection between their cyber life and their physical life, that brand will become equally important when they face a choice about whether to use a service or buy a product. If it's important to them, then brand will matter. And there will be other ways to deal with trust. For example, in the medical arena, you may decide that there's a person or a third-party organization that you'll decide to trust for an opinion that is not a brand. It's a bit like why do in the United States people use Consumer Reports? It's an independent nonprofit testing organization, and they want an opinion, a third-party opinion. So more and more, I think you'll see all those kind of mechanisms emerge for these systems as well.
Now for another issue our policy team is focusing on, resilience to extreme weather. In mid-January, the chair of our recently published resilience report, Professor Georgina Mace, presented the report's findings at a conference on disaster risk reduction in Tokyo. The conference focused on the role that science can play in reducing disaster risks. It aimed to inform negotiations in the lead-up to the World Conference on Disaster Risk Reduction, which takes place in March in Sendai, and where a new UN framework for disasters will be agreed. In the margins of the conference, we spoke to Professor Gordon McBean, President of the International Council for Science, to get his views on the role of science in international efforts to reduce risk and build resilience.
Professor McBean, what role do you think science has to play in the next UN disasters framework?
I think there's a very important role for science because we have to be able to specify how we can make a difference so that the implementation, the use of science, will actually result in reduced impacts, lives saved, economic costs reduced. And so our science needs to be, let's say, focused in the way that we can show the benefits of it and present it to local, to national, to international platforms in a way they can use it and see the ways of using it as opposed to being, let's say, I might say, relatively academic.
And so with only a couple of months to go until the next framework is agreed in Sendai in Japan, are you feeling optimistic in terms of the direction that the negotiations are going in, particularly with regards to science?
I think relatively optimistic. We're following almost daily the negotiations that are actually underway in Geneva right now. Virginia Murray sends me an email almost every day to many of us. And so far, the words on the science, which are not very many, but are still there. And so I think we're optimistic. But the key thing, though, is going to be that the governments, when they complete the agreement in Sendai, go home with the intentions of doing something as opposed to saying, well, we've done that, next item. Because there's been too much of that in international negotiations. If I can talk for one more second, I was the government science advisor in the Kyoto Protocol negotiations, and I came back in the Canadian scene. We didn't do much. We finally got the government to start take action, then we had a change of government, and we've done nothing. So I think the agreement is very important as to how it is worded, but even more importantly is the sense of commitment of governments that they hopefully will make and carry through on in the post-Sendai, quite literally decades to come.
So the agreement is really just the first step to a much longer process?
Very much so. It's part of an international process which seems to be embedded in our mentality, but its implementation of these things often depend on what, unfortunately, tragic events. The agreement in Kobe in 2005 was different and probably more pronounced, more focused, more commitment, at least initially, because of the tragic Indian Ocean tsunami that happened just before it. And its unfortunate reality is that politicians respond to those kind of very dramatic events that create public pressure to do something. So we'll see, but we hope. I'm optimistic.
Great. Well, on that note, thank you very much, Professor McBean.
You're very welcome.
Staying on the theme of international efforts, it is now officially the International Year of Light. This year, we will see special efforts across the globe to raise awareness of the role of light in our daily lives and how it has revolutionised technologies, including areas like medicine and communication. A school in Shropshire is raising awareness of light in their Royal Society Partnership Grants project called The Science of Seeing. The partnership for the project is between Dr. Alan Herbert from the University of Birmingham and the Corbett School. We spoke to two of the project students about how they have been testing for blind spots and what it's like doing a partnership grant project with Dr. Herbert.
Originally we just had a piece of paper, we rested our chin on the table. Then we had to measure our degree of our angle.
So you had your chin on the table and you were measuring how far you could see?
Yeah. We had this piece of paper that had a cross and a circle. And you had to cover one eye and look directly at the cross and then move the paper back and forward until you couldn't see the circle anymore. And when you couldn't, you'd measure the distance between your chin and the paper.
So that's a blind spot.
Yeah, and then you'd measure the distance between the spot and the cross and then join those two lines together. And then you'd measure the angle of the triangle that you made.
What did you find out?
Most of us had roughly the same blind spot.
But we did it for the whole school because we did it at our Year 11 parents' evening for the adults as well to see if there was any difference between the children and the adults.
On the internet that American Army people had a different blind spot to us, and we didn't know if that was different.
Can they see more or less?
We're not sure at the minute because we did it last week.
Dr. Herbert, that's your scientist partner. Is it good that you have someone who's not a teacher?
He knows what he's talking about.
Sometimes it can be confusing what he says, but you just ask him and he'll explain it in a bit further detail so we can understand what each of the things mean.
So how does that compare to if Dr. Herbert wasn't here? And I know your teacher's great, but if Dr. Herbert wasn't here...
I don't think we'd be doing as much things like programming things.
Because even Miss Gerard, our teacher, doesn't have a clue what... And Miss Clark doesn't have a clue what Dr. Herbert is talking about.
Sometimes.
When he's doing all our programming, they're like, how on earth is that? In a couple of weeks ago, we made using the boards that we've got at the moment.
Red boards.
And Miss Gerard and Miss Clark were struggling really badly with that, and I think there's went really wrong at one point.
So not only you've learned about this, but your teachers have as well.
Yeah.
They teach us most of the time, and then sometimes we teach them what Dr. Herbert's talking about because we know what he's talking about, what we don't. So it's weird sometimes.
So you're faster at learning than your own teachers.
The Partnership Grant Scheme funds up to £3,000 for school science investigation projects at primary, secondary or college level in partnership with a practicing scientist or engineer. If you want to know how a partnership grant can happen at a school near you, visit our website and search Partnership Grants.
Finally, on a slightly different note this month, instead of why science, as part of our Publishing 350 celebrations, we're asking why philosophical transactions?
I think Philtrans has lasted a long time because the Royal Society has lasted a long time. But it's also really remarkable that back in 1665, you know, they essentially developed the ideas that still hold today. We write things, we get our peers to look at them, they're published, we get our name on them and the date on them so people know who is first, and then they're there. You know, it's a fantastic achievement, and that's still how science works. It enables science to be incremental. We always build on what everyone has done before. So in that sense, you know, though it was first, it's hardly surprising that it's lasted.
I think it was in perhaps what it might be described in its middle age, given that it's 350 years old, it was a very influential publication. And I think I and my colleagues here at the Society are keen to use the 350th anniversary to make the current philosophical transactions even more influential than it has been in the past.
So it's precisely that method of seeing for yourself and doing the experiments and then telling other people exactly how you did them and inviting them in a way to check it out themselves that has been this at the root of this incredible success story.
Thanks for joining us, and be sure to catch our next episode in February. Goodbye.
Bye.